This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, bridge writer Ted Roloffs examines the various proposals for prison reform and how it's become an issue with liberal and conservative champions. But first, it's almost time for children to head back to school. The learning environment and quality of instruction are important for a child's education, but so is the environment at home, especially for young children before they head off to start school. That's part of the idea behind Parents as Teachers. Community Healing Centers received funding from the Learning Network of Greater Kalamazoo and the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo region to launch Parents as Teachers last year. We're going to talk some more about that with Christy Carambula, who's Director of Early Childhood Programs for the Kalamazoo Regional Educational Service Agency, and Bianca Harris, one of the parent educators. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basic idea. How does Parents as Teachers work?
The intent of Parents as Teachers, when it was created back in the 1970s, actually in St. Louis, Missouri, was to teach parents how to be their child's first and most important teacher, starting at birth, and in fact, some cases, thinking about it prenatally and preparing for that all-important job of being a parent. Over the years, it's become a tried-and-true, evidence-based curriculum that our community has determined will be offered with complete fidelity, meaning that every piece of the curriculum will be addressed, the spacing of the home visits will be as prescribed, and the impact that we should have in helping parents prepare their children for pre-K and beyond is really quite impressive.
How many people are there like you, Bianca, who are actually doing this parent who are working with the parents themselves?
Well, there are quite a few of us that are working at my agency. Right now, there's about 5 or 6 of us, and we have a caseload between 10 and 25 families that we work with on a monthly basis. So, you know, we are in the homes either biweekly or monthly or once a month, just depending on the needs of the family. And when we go in there, you know, we're just, as Christy already stated, you know, we're bringing in things to help the family impart to their children and to help them, you know, prepare their child for school.
And Community Healing Center, which Bianca is representing, is one of 5 partners that have formed this consortium to do Parents as Teachers. So right now we have a total of 19 certified parent educators using the Parents as Teachers curriculum.
How many families are being served?
Last year we made 2,233 home visits with a total of over 350 families.
Are you able to meet the needs of everyone who would like assistance, or is there some sort of a screening process to decide who should have a parent educator come in?
We'd like to be available to all families. We really think it's important that, because we know children don't come with directions and there's no set recipe for each child, our ideal would be to have the parent leave the hospital knowing with their newborn who their parent educator is. The reality is we don't have the capacity to do that. And so every Tuesday morning, the group meets and does what we call Tuesday triage, which is to look at the referrals that are coming directly out of our 2 birthing hospitals and other referrals that might be coming from pediatricians or social workers or whomever, and sort of deal them out to make sure that the families with the highest need are being invited into the services first.
But there is no sort of income requirement or anything like that, and anybody can at least put in a request.
Exactly. We really want to see, especially first-time parents, getting this kind of support. Families, of course, with risk factors, which can include anything from housing, mobility, to income, to other sorts of issues. We'd really like to make sure they're wrapped with these services as well.
Bianca, tell us a little bit about your background, because I guess I'm curious as to what sort of people are the ones who, like yourself, go in and deal with parents and try to help them be, as Christy says, their first most important teacher.
Right. Well, prior to becoming a parent educator, I've worked with children. I was a youth development specialist for a while, and I worked in a daycare as a daycare attendant. And so, you know, working with children and kids and things, you know, prior to my position as a parent educator, kind of already prepared me with working with children and working with parents. And then becoming a parent educator, that helped me to just be able to take everything that I've done in my prior positions and bring that into the homes and things. So, you know, being able to go into the homes and work now one-on-one on a sit-down basis and, you know, talk to parents and work with the children, bring in activities. It's something I really enjoy. I enjoy helping children learn. I enjoy helping parents learn. So being able to do those things and coming to the homes and knowing that I'm bringing in tips and tools and ideas that will help foster child's development and help pour into the parents where they can pour into their child makes a great difference, and I really enjoy it.
Why is it important that you come into their home as opposed to them coming to you someplace, perhaps, you know, in a classroom type setting?
Well, at the end of the day, the child is going to be in their home the majority of the time, and we want the parent to feel as comfortable as possible. So we, you know, want to go into their comfort zone. We want to make the parent feel, you know, relaxed, and we want to bring activities into the home that they can do while at home. You know, of course, children go to school and things, but for the most part, from birth up until 3 or 4 years old, that child's at home all the time. So that's why it's important for us to go to the parent, to, you know, go into the home, and also to assess the needs in the home. Sometimes, you know, when we go in, we can kind of see there's, you know, more needs than just bringing in activities. Maybe the family are, you know, is in need of better housing, or they need, you know, other resources like food or different things. So when we can go into the home and kind of see things on a one-on-one basis, it gives us more of a broad idea of what else they need besides just parenting tips and tools.
And part of the intent of home visits is helping the parent identify and use materials that already exist in the home as learning opportunities. You know, open up the drawer that has Tupperware and plastic containers, and you can do stacking and counting and color identification, and there's all kinds of stuff. They don't have to become stockholders in Fisher-Price or, you know, any of those companies that make very fun and colorful toys for kids.
Are people also a little more receptive when they are in their own home to perhaps hearing what you have to say, as opposed to maybe being in a classroom where it might feel a little more like they're being instructed as opposed to a true learning, more of a give and take that you might have in their home?
They are. The program is all volunteer-based. So when a parent chooses, you know, accepts the program, that means they're already opening up their home to say, sure, come in. We want to hear what you have to say and things. So to have someone come into, you know, their home, that makes them feel comfortable already. And then to be in a place where they feel comfortable, you know, is something that they're familiar with. They don't feel like they have to leave and pack their children up and worry about transportation. Everything is brought to them. So, you know, if they don't have transportation, that's not a problem. We, you know, can come to them. If they don't have the needs or the means to do certain things, like, well, I don't have the funding for a cab, or I don't have a babysitter, it's not about that. You don't need a babysitter. We're there to come and help you. So I do think parents are more receptive when we are able to come to their homes.
And we're adaptable. If families live in a bit of a chaotic setting, maybe they're bunking in with other family or friends, we'll meet them in a neutral spot like the children's library or McDonald's Playland, someplace else where they can feel comfortable with their children. We have been known to make home visits at the Gospel Mission, mm-hmm. at the YWCA Domestic Assault Shelter. So whatever is even temporarily home, we'll meet them there.
So as I was reading up on some of what's taught here, there's the idea of trying to get parents to encourage their children more than perhaps speaking in sort of an authoritative way. Is that also a way that you have to approach parents? Because, when you tell someone how to be a parent, they may feel somewhat defensive that I'm not doing the job right. So is there a certain way, Bianca, that you have to approach a parent in order to really teach them and work with them?
There is. You know, one of the things that I always tell parents, you know, once I explain the program and they decide to accept the services, I let them know once we have our initial visit, I am not here to tell you how to be a parent. I am simply here just to bring tools and to help you facilitate your child's development. Because the one thing no one wants to hear is I'm a bad parent or I'm this and that. And that automatically will build up a wall and cause a shutdown. So, you know, one thing that we try to make sure we do when we approach a parent, try to approach with sensitivity and to let them know, you know, to encourage them and always give that positive reinforcement. It's like, hey, you know, you're doing a good job, you know, love this and that. And also with us doing observation, it gives us a chance to see the good things that they're doing. So it's like, hey, I love the way you're interacting with your child. I love the way that you are, you know, building that secure attachment. And that helps build up their confidence and also lets them know, okay, you're not here to tell me what I'm doing wrong. You're here to help me. And that's what we want to do. We're here to help. We're not here to condemn. We're not here to bash.
What is the evidence out there about how these types of programs work? What do they do for children down the road, Christy?
Sure. So part of what we do implementing Parents as Teachers is ongoing child development screening with the parent so that the parent actually learns how to use the tool and can do their own screening and determination of how their child's developing. If the parent kind of owns the child's development and therefore their early education, it's been proven in the research that's been done over the years, starting in Missouri and now nationwide and actually around the world, that the parents continue to own their child's education. So they are more likely to form partnerships with their teachers. They're more likely to attend conferences at school. They're more likely to make decisions on where they live and how they spend their time based on what their child needs developmentally and educationally. And they are more satisfied with their role as a parent. They can't all be full-time parents. Work kind of gets in the way of that, and sometimes a parent's own education. But when they are spending time with their child, it's been shown that they're much more engaged and much more positive. That doesn't mean that they're lollipops and sticker parents, but that means that they are fully engaged in support of their child's education and development. And Bianca's point about approaching the parent with unconditional positive regard is the whole point of this program. Every parent wants to be the best parent they can be. Every parent loves their child. And that's the assumption we make as we go in. And then the rest is being that neutral pair of eyes that really helps them see and watch their child develop. It's a little different than your mother-in-law at Christmas time saying, something's wrong here, for somebody else to come in and say, something's really right here, and you're on the right track.
The focus is on very young children, correct? What age range are we talking about?
Our focus is birth to three, and we will do some visits even prenatally. If there are older children in the environment when they're there, we don't ignore them, right, Bianca? We engage
Absolutely.
Them as well and give the parents some tips on that development. But all of our current team of parent educators have been trained in the birth to three curriculum.
What does the future look like? Are the plans to continue Parents as Teachers, and are there any thoughts out there that maybe the program could expand?
So the Learning Network funding was seed money. It was for a year. The United Way is making a longer-term commitment to this effort, and we've just received funding from the Kalamazoo Community Foundation as well to kind of replace some of the Learning Network funds. At the state level and the federal level, they're seeing this particular program and a couple others like it as being incredibly important, and are talking about and have actually applied some of the Affordable Care Act money to this home visiting process. Kalamazoo County is in line for some of that funding. It would be great if this just became part of what we do for all families in our area. I think we would see a higher rate of school success overall and certainly a higher rate of engaged parents mm-hmm. overall.
Does this sort of fit in with some of the emphasis then on early childhood education that we're hearing more about? Casey Ready 4s, for example, here in Kalamazoo County, the push at the state level for more quality preschool. Does this make up part of that whole fabric of the early years being crucial?
It's an important piece of the puzzle because now we have put some fairly significant state and federal dollars and private dollars with Casey Ready 4s into four-year-old programming and in some cases three-year-old pre-K. But those children don't arrive at three-year-old or four-year-old pre-K as blank slates. They arrive with stuff already having happened in their life. And we know that with brain development being the most significant during the first 3 years, and in fact the first 1,000 days of a child's life, there's huge building blocks there that need to be laid in terms of a foundation. And if they come to 3 or 4 year old pre-K already with a learning gap, that's just going to continue. So it isn't that all these kids have to be mathematicians or scientists by the age mm-hmm. of three. But if they know how to get along in a group, if they know that they have the love and support of their parents and they have a lot of the pre-elements of reading and math and science, they're going to just be that much better off.
Christy Carambula and Bianca Harris, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christy Carambula is Director of Early Childhood Programs for KRESA. Bianca Harris is one of the parent educators for the Parents as Teachers program. You can find a link with more information about Parents as Teachers at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Prison reform has become an issue that people on many parts of the political spectrum are willing to consider and advocate for. An article for Bridge, the online news service of the Center for Michigan, says the state had a prison population of more than 43,700 in 2013, the most recent figures available. The question is who among those prisoners should be released. Ted Roloffs wrote the stories for Bridge on prison reform. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So that number of 43,700, maybe more than that now, depending on what's happened to the prison population in the last couple of years, is there some sort of general consensus amongst people who may see the world very differently otherwise that that's just too many people in prison in Michigan?
I could say yes and no to that. I think there's an emerging level of consensus that hasn't been there before that we have too many people in prison in Michigan. It's not unanimous. If you talk to the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, he's still pretty adamant that it's a public safety issue. The people that are in prison are there because they've committed serious crimes and that public safety should always be the top priority. So he's been generally resistant to a lot of the reform ideas that have come about. But, you know, in the last couple, 3 years, there's been an emerging consensus among a variety of surprising figures in the Republican side of things that not just in Michigan, but nationally, that our way of approaching crime and punishment hasn't worked, that we're spending too much money on incarcerating people and not looking at alternatives to putting people in jail or prison. So that's kind of where it stands.
Is there anybody out there that puts out a number that says, you know, if we were doing things right, our prison population would be X?
Well, there is a group that works pretty much 24/7 on prison reform in Michigan that issued an analysis, I think it was a couple months ago, and they had a dizzying number of recommendations, something like 24 changes in sentencing practice and all sorts of things, parole and probation changes that ultimately added up to 10,000 fewer prisoners if you adopted all those measures. Now, politically, at this point in time in Michigan, that's more of a fantasy than reality. But I think when I looked at this issue, and it's enormously complex, I keep going back to, I look at the numbers. People in prison in Michigan in 1985 was about 18,000. 10 years later, that went to 41,000. That's in only 10 years. It reached 51,000 in 2006, and now it's come back down to where it seems to be sort of hovering somewhere, you know, a little bit above 40,000, 43,000 or so. The population in Michigan obviously did not go up 2.5 times between 1985 and 1995. I mean, basically, the population in Michigan has remained relatively flat going back to 85 compared to the prison population. So I kept asking myself, why do we have nearly 3 times the people in prison that we did back in the 80s? And I know some of the reasons why: the changes in legislation and more aggressive prosecution, war on drugs, all that happened. But it still is hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that we have so many more people in prison in Michigan, and this is true in other states as well, than we did back in the 70s and in the 80s. So I think that, you know, it's also at some point, especially when states have tight budgets, you ask yourself, in Michigan, can we afford a $2 billion annual prison budget, which is pretty much what we have in Michigan right now? And part of what I looked at, it's not a big part of the prison population, but in Michigan, and these to me are just numbers, you can ask the question, and there's different answers, but there were 67 people in prison for failing to pay child support, 277 for passing bad checks, 515 for shoplifting. You can go back and forth on putting people in prison for failing to pay child support. To me, it's pretty hard to make an argument that someone that doesn't pay child support is a threat to public safety. This seems to be a punitive thing. And you could also say, well, he's in prison for failing to pay child support, so obviously he's not going to be paying child support while he's in prison. And in fact, you've reduced the likelihood that that individual, when he gets out, is ever going to be able to pay child support because of his prison record. So these are just questions you raise, and there's different answers to them, of course.
Is it just as simple, though, as saying, let's find everyone in prison who's a nonviolent offender and releasing them into the public?
Well, no, it's not that simple, and I don't know that serious reform advocates say that what we need to do is just go through the entire population and arbitrarily release a lot of people. It has to be changes in sentencing practices. It has to be looking at how the probation and parole system is enforced. Do you want to send people back to prison if they're on parole or probation and they commit some sort of technical violation of their parole, and therefore we're going to send them back to prison when that technical violation is, again, maybe a minor crime or something as small, in some cases, as failing to indicate a change in address, missing appointments? Do we want to reincarcerate people for violations like that?
So if we're going to send fewer people to prison to start with, what are some of the ideas out there for perhaps alternatives, things that could be done instead of jail time that might still serve as some sort of a corrective measure for someone who has committed a crime or been convicted of it?
Well, I mean, those alternatives include, in some cases, I had a retired circuit court judge that this to me was pretty interesting. He did for, I believe it was his master's thesis, a project where he analyzed all the people that had come before his court in the course of maybe it was 15 years, looked at every single case, and found that I think 70% of the people that he sentenced, their crimes were somehow drug-related. And by that, he means not just the person selling drugs, that sort of thing, but that the person had some kind of a drug problem, seeking drugs, committing a crime in order to get money, to get drugs. And his point was that we have a disease problem in these cases, not necessarily purely a criminal problem. And what we're doing right now isn't working. So he would advocate a much broader treatment, substance abuse treatment for people in order to prevent them from committing future crimes. But of course, that's something that would take, to do it on a significant scale, would take a big investment of money. And again, politically, it's the kind of thing that's going to be very hard to sell to people, that we've got this criminal and we're not going to send this person to prison. We're going to send them to treatment. And that's not always an easy sell. But as the article indicated, I think the most significant opportunity for reform is arising at this time, because you've got a lot of people coming from the political right saying we've got to do something different because what we're doing now isn't working. It's too costly and it's not necessarily making us safer.
When you break down these statistics by race, what do we see about how white defendants and African-American defendants and perhaps other minorities, Hispanic, may be treated differently in the criminal justice system in Michigan?
The disparity is pretty eye-opening in the rate at which Hispanics and African-Americans are incarcerated. I think it's on the order of 3 to 4 times more in proportion to the population. And that's not at all unique to Michigan. You're going to find those same kinds of numbers across the country. And that gets to be, again, it's a very complex issue to say it's as simple as, well, it's not simply we're discriminating against African Americans because we want to incarcerate more of them. You're going to also find in many cases you've got people living in much higher crime neighborhoods, and that's where police enforcement efforts are focused, and that's how you get more people wrapped up in the criminal justice system, but it's an open question as to whether or not justice is always fair and always blind in these cases.
One of the things you tell us in the article is that Michigan's prison population is aging, bringing with it added costs. A 2013 report by the House Fiscal Agency finds that the percentage of inmates in their 50s and 60s more than tripled between 1994 and 2002. What are the implications of that for the criminal justice system and the costs in Michigan? And what are some ideas that people have about someone who might have been in prison for such a long time that they really aren't really ready to go out and just sort of be dropped into the public on their own?
Well, it's as the prison population gets older, it gets much more expensive because we're paying for their health care. This is the Senate Fiscal Agency from 2010. Average health care cost for prisoners 35 to 39 is $4,800. That goes to $9,000 for those 50 to 54, $16,000 for those 65 to 69, $40,000 for those over 80. So the older the prisoners get, the more expensive it is to keep them there to pay for their health care. And as the portion of prisoners gets older, you can see what's going to happen to the expense. There is a state representative who has now left office who worked on prison reform for some years, Joe Haveman out of Holland. And he had talked about, and this never came to fruition while he was in office, but looking at maybe releasing some of the geriatric and sick prisoners to a facility that would be outside the scope of the prison system, where much of their cost would then be picked up by Medicaid. There's a program like that started, I think it was last year or the year before, in Connecticut. So, again, this is the kind of thing where you can look at, ask these philosophic questions about people in prison into their 70s and 80s, and they may have been there 40 years or longer. Is this, again, a matter of, is this a punitive decision that we're going to keep you in this prison until you die, and we're going to pay however much it costs to keep you in prison until you die because you did something we don't like? In many cases, this might have been murder 40, 50 years ago. Or do we look at a person at the end of their life and realize that person is absolutely incapable of posing any risk to society? Are there other ways of dealing with this?
So I have to note that the first comment that comes after your story on the Bridge website says, whatever is decided, the fingers will be pointing and accusations made about poor decision-making when an early release prisoner commits murder or some other serious crime with a lot of I told you so's.
Uh-huh.
And I have to wonder if anybody you talked to expressed some concern that could be the way it plays out, that we make prison reform, somebody gets out, they do something terrible, and the reaction by the public is, how could you have let that person out of prison to commit this horrible crime?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a valid point. And some of the people I spoke to do acknowledge that, and they would also say, at least the reform advocates, that if you're serious about reform, you have to be willing to make change. And there's no guarantee. And that is a possibility, and it's a possibility that if something like that happens, that it will be widely politicized. Of course, that's a possibility. However, I think in the long run, if people are serious about reform, you move forward despite that possibility, because, I mean, ultimately, there's no guarantees in anything. I mean, you could make that argument given the way things are right now, and someone's let out of prison, let's say, at his minimum sentence date, and then 2 days later commits a horrible crime. Well, the parole board should have kept that person in prison longer. They should have had a crystal ball to know that person's going to commit that crime 2 days later. So there's never any guarantees.
Ted Roloffs, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to do it.
You can read Ted Roloff's stories for Bridge on prison reform through a link at our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.